Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, South Africa's driver's license backlog could drag into next year and government is under increasing pressure to fix it. Transnet opens rail to 11 private operators. Can this finally unstick freight? Miners warn that proposed new laws will choke investment and cost South African jobs. And new divorce reforms may override prenups and your home and properties are at stake. It's Tuesday, the 26th of August. Now, South Africa's driver's license card backlog is still a problem. It's massive, with the department confirming something in the region of 500,000 cards outstanding after the February breakdown of the country's single 1998-era card printer, only restored in May. Turnaround is sitting at roughly 2 months, but government is aiming to clear the logjam, it says, by December, and motorists have a three-month grace period if they can show proof of application. Yet there are some reports warning that delays could spill into next year. Let's explore this in a little more detail. Colin Msibi is with us, who speaks for the Transport Ministry. So, Colin, first of all, can you confirm the exact number as far as the backlog is concerned, and what does it look like across provinces?
Thanks for having us, Jeremy. Well, I can confirm that the backlog at the moment is standing at 539,000 cards that are ready to be printed. In terms of the cards that we've already printed up to the 11th of August, the number may have improved by now, but up to the 11th of August, we had already printed about 834,000 cards from the backlog. And the reason why the number keeps on rising, you'd recall that we started at 733,000, the backlog. So we're now at 500. But for somebody else, it would be like it's not going down. And the reason is that on a daily basis, we get more than 10,000 applications. So we've got to balance the equation in terms of the backlog as well as the new applications that come through.
You've got a 2025 clearance goal. That then seems to be very ambitious. What is that based on? And do you have a plan B if the machine fails again?
Well, the reality is that we're aiming for December to have cleared the backlog. And we try to do monthly updates in terms of what's happening. The backup we are talking about, indeed, there is something in the pipeline. We're talking to the Department of Home Affairs. In fact, we've already even signed the Memorandum of Understanding with them so that we have an interim solution which was announced by the minister. So that is within distance. We should be able to achieve that sooner than later. So it is mainly to ensure that if we have a problem again with this machine, we should be able to have the alternative. In fact, once we have that interim solution, I think we are likely to move towards the interim solution so that we basically get rid of the headache of this particular machine that we have.
Let's get back to the machine in just a moment, but you talk about 10,000 new applications per day in spite of the Memorandum of Understanding with the Department of Home Affairs. Is that clearance goal realistic, do you think?
Look, I think for now, in terms of the analysis, remember we keep on changing. Initially, we had said the waiting period for the public or motorists to get their license was 4 to 6 weeks. We've had to do another analysis, which tells us that you need at least 6 to 8 weeks to be able to receive your card. So that is based on the applications that we are receiving on a daily basis, because that number fluctuates moves from 10,000, sometimes it's 14,000, and it keeps on changing. So hence, it is important to be honest with the public, but also to ensure that even ourselves, when we do our analysis, we are able to say, is December still feasible? So that is why it's important to keep on coming to your stations and to be able to update the public in this regard.
Are you confident that you're in control of the situation?
Look, we are cautiously optimistic. I think we are, to an extent, in control. But where we really struggle is the fact that we're dealing with a very old machine. It's 28 years old. It's difficult to get even the parts when it breaks down. So we've got to, let me take an example now. When it broke down on the 5th of February, we've had to look within the country first of the parts that had broken down. We couldn't find them. So we've had to go out of South Africa to be able to source the parts and to go to the original manufacturer of the machine. So that is where we're able to get assistance. So hence I'm saying we're cautiously optimistic. I mean, if something were to happen today, whether we will be able to get the parts, whatever the part that would have broken, is another question, and which is why it becomes difficult to say 100% to you, we are in control of this particular machine. I don't think we are. I think it takes us a bit of time to be able to fix it. So we've got to be honest.
It's extraordinary that you're still reliant on a single 1998 machine and that there is no backup site after all of these years.
Yes, I think when we started having problems with this machine, it was around the COVID period. And then immediately we had to go to cabinet in August 2022 to say we've got to have a new machine in place. We started the tender process, and I think we went out on tender around November 2022. We couldn't find a suitable service provider at the time. And then we went back again in 2023, I think it was April 2023. And that process took us to where we are now, where the DLCA bid committee did find a suitable service provider in terms of their own assessment. And unfortunately, we are in a situation where we've got to go to court because we realized that there were some irregularities during the tendering process. So the story I'm painting is that when it started giving us problems, we had to act. I cannot obviously account for the periods before that because, we should have known at the time that this is the only one machine, anything can happen. But I think we at least acted in 2022 in that regard. So we are stuck with this court process. We're not so sure how long it will take, but we obviously cannot proceed with a service provider knowing full well that there's been problems, which were questioned even by the Auditor General to say there's some findings in terms of the processes that we follow. So we've had to go to court and say, maybe let's set this aside and start the process afresh. So that would lead us to having more machines. I don't think it would be the same make of the machine we have, but there will be a backup, a proper backup. But I think this time we've planned accordingly. But it's just that the DLCA the process, it was just, it had these laws, which has made us to go to court to set this aside.
In the meantime, the backlog is going to continue to mount.
The backlog is going to continue to mount, unfortunately, Jeremy. But as I say to you, for now, the machine hasn't given us problems. But secondly, we believe that the solution, interim solution with the Home Affairs is within touch distance. We should be able to be announcing in not so distant future in terms of that particular interim solution. So we honestly are banking on the interim solution because we're not too sure how long the court process will take us.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Colin Namsibi, who speaks for the Transport Ministry.
Smart minds, big moves, one summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers and decision makers at the Moneyweb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Centre. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part? Your ticket is free. Just use the code MONEYWEBGUEST when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. MoneyWeb Money Summit, where smart money moves.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's ailing rail system is opening its tracks to private operators, you would have heard. It's a move that's been hailed as long overdue by some and a desperate stopgap by others. After years of Transnet's decline, the regulator has finally awarded slots to private freight rail companies. Supporters say competition could revive efficiency, attract investment, and ease pressure on road freight. Critics are warning, though, it may be a little too late with major or without major reforms to infrastructure governance and security. So let's try and pull all of that together. It is a very important issue. It has huge ramifications for the South African economy. And a transport economist, Dr. Joachim Vermoorden, is with me. Dr. Vermoorden, a very warm welcome. So maybe just tell me, in your opinion, how significant this move is. Is it a turning point, or is Transnet, is government just tinkering at the edges here?
No, I think it's a real turning point. Transnet had a monopoly over rail for many years, and as a result of protecting the monopoly, it also got the monopoly over pipelines way back, and harbors and ports, you know. So it's high time that it actually gets going, because we live in a competitive world. And that's what we need.
Do you think, though, that private operators are going to be able to overcome the infrastructure decay that they will inherit from Transnet? That surely is a big hurdle.
Yeah, that is a hurdle, but the minister has promised substantial funds for Transnet to actually fix things, because the rail network has actually been designed from a monopoly perspective, and from a competitive perspective, you need to make room for other competitors to operate, and that scheduling can take place in everybody's interest. So it actually needs a number of issues. Doing business issues that still need to be developed. And the one is, of course, equality of treatment and the competitive neutrality. You know, of course, the regulators, wherever you say place them, will be government controlled, as well as the operator. So you need a system to actually assure competitive neutrality.
And that's absolutely critical, I imagine, because this has got to lead to real competition, as you've suggested, and more importantly, perhaps gains in efficiency. We cannot have a new monopoly under a different name.
That's correct. You know, like the access costs, you know, would have to be thought about very clearly. We can't just dump on, you know, the inefficiency and sunk cost of the existing rail system. You really have to move towards a marginal cost, you know, the additional cost to actually create a competitive network and not the old monopoly-based system. Otherwise, your entry cost is just too high and it becomes a barrier of entry on its own.
And Dr. Vermoorden, inevitably this is going to impact road freight congestion and our battered highways, but I would also imagine it's going to take some time before we start seeing a real change in that respect.
Yeah, I think it will affect the bulk volume type of products first, but, you know, things don't happen overnight, you know, the sun's come up tomorrow morning and many things have to happen, you know. So I think it would be more gradual than a sudden death, if I can call it like that.
And critical, Dr. Vermoorden, that, and it's, I guess it's back to the regulation debate, that safeguards exist preventing private players from cherry-picking the profitable routes and leaving the others to rot. Again, that's got to be well-managed, well-evaluated.
Yeah, that's a whole discussion on its own. Obviously, you need to actually be able to earn a reasonable return on your investments. And in order to do that, you need to be have some freedom in pricing. You know, a single pricing structure generally doesn't work well in competitive markets. And ultimately, you develop a higher pricing for the most desirable type of operations and timing, you know. So We need a system that follows an open type of commercial market. And one has to track it from the demand side to say, okay, what do customers really want? And then things would actually resolve themselves.
And how difficult is it going to be to do that, do you think? Because the expectation from customers is that they want quicker rather than later, lower logistics costs.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's why I think, you know, it's very important to look at the whole issue of business, you know, business rules or the business aspects of things. You know, take away first, you know, physical barriers, regulatory barriers. And then, of course, there are many commercial barriers, as we've seen deregulation or liberalization of many, many other sectors of the economy. One could be, you know, that a dominant carrier may induce customers with incentive schemes that are anti-competitive. You know, that's the easiest to do, and it locks up the market. Then secondly, you need to incentivize the existing dominant carrier, because its incentive schemes for its people to operate actually are geared towards maintaining a monopoly, and you would have to have the same incentives for the dominant carrier as you would have for the smaller carriers. So there's a lot of work to do to be done, but a major step has been done in the meanwhile.
And I guess we've got to ask the question as to where this leaves Transnet. Do these opening of the slots, do you think, address the root causes of the collapse of this entity, or is this simply papering them over?
I think there's many things to do within Transnet. I think the big issue is it's of a very large scale and of operation, and the best way to actually fix things is actually look at things in a smaller way. You know, so I'm very glad that specific routes have been, you know, opened up for competitive services. But ultimately, the you know, in all transport mechanisms, you have a network, and your real advantage of network size is economies of scope. The larger the network and so on, the more advantageous it should be. So there needs to be a crossing at some point, you know, to create larger levels of competition. Transnet itself would have to adjust towards a competitive type of situation. That doesn't mean that it needs to focus on the areas of market dominance, but it needs to fix itself from the angle of economy and efficiencies. And of course, vehicles, you know, you can't retain the same approach towards vehicles. If you look at your own car, if you drive an 80-year-old car, you know, its economies would be different from a modern car, you know, as far as operating conditions are concerned. So, you know, one shouldn't leave it too late, but you know, the approach of innovation and entrepreneurship is a very important element in these markets.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Joachim Vermeulen, who is a transport economist, and thank you for shedding some light, sir, on the challenges that lie ahead for the freight and logistics sector. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The new draft Mineral Resources Development Bill, it's now out for public comment, promises transformation and tighter regulation. But the Minerals Council, which represents around 90% of the country's mineral production, has sounded the alarm. They say the bill, in its current form, risks chasing away investment, stalling exploration, and costing much-needed jobs. Well, let's get a view on that. I'm in conversation now with the Chief Executive Officer of the Council, Mzila Mtanjani. Mzila, welcome to you. And you say the bill in its current form can't drive growth. What is the single biggest red flag for you?
Thank you very much for having me, Jeremy. And I think it's a great time to be having this conversation. And I think in response to your question, the number one principle in terms of the legislation is around certainty and predictability. And why that is important is that in the context of the imperative to drive investment and growth into our economy and into mining, it involves a significant amount of capital over a long period of time. And that certainty and predictability in terms of what the law expects and provides for during the tenure of that investment is absolutely critical. And this is a point that we are discussing with the DMPR in terms of the manner in which it is drafting the law, in terms of definitions and clauses that they should not be subject to too much interpretation. I mean, we're not saying it should be perfect. And then the other point I'd like to elaborate on in terms of certainty and predictability is that the manner in which it is administered. And what that means is we've got a law, we understand what it says, how it's then implemented in terms of what you should and shouldn't do also needs to be a point of certainty. So when it comes to how long it should take to receive a prospecting or a mining right, I think the law must be administered to the letter. If it's going to be 60 days, it needs to be 60 days or 180 days or 300 days. You know, that is important in as far as enabling planning and investing in the mining industry. And then the last point is around ministerial discretion that, and this is where predictability is important, that the law shouldn't change. And at the moment, there are several pieces of the legislation which make reference to regulations that are yet to be made public. And so with that uncertainty, we will find that investors will continue to stand on the sideline.
I wonder if the exploration horse, though, has not already bolted. If I look at the hard data, and correct me if I've misinterpreted them, exploration spend was around 6 billion rand in 2006. 2023, just over 700 million rand. Surely it shows that government policy in this respect has already failed the sector.
So I think to an extent, but I caveat that with the view that, you know, investors are constantly looking for opportunities to invest and get a return. And there's been an increasing number of other opportunities where investors can get pretty safe returns. I mean, you know, we look at how global capital has shifted towards technology, AI. Amongst a handful of investment opportunities. Secondly, South Africa has suffered along with other jurisdictions and particularly the rest of the continent because in terms of companies looking for growth in mining, they've also pursued mergers and acquisitions, which are relatively less risky than greenfields mining. So, and the point here is that, you know, greenfields mining, exploration, there's a constant competition for capital. And so as a country, we constantly need to be aware of that and be positioning ourselves to be a preferred destination. It will not happen by virtue of the fact that we have the minerals in the ground. That's an investment opportunity. But, you know, we need to make sure that anyone who decides to invest in that is guaranteed of a return on that on their capital and the safety of their investment as well.
There is the argument that South Africa's mining industry already has an outsized influence on policy. Is your argument not just protecting big business interests over national goals?
Not at all. Far from it. I mean, I think, and at times, this is what we feel, we constantly have to defend ourselves as a mining industry, given the social and economic impact that mining has on South Africa's economy. And I think, secondly, you look at the progress that the mining industry has made in terms of transformation, which, you know, in the context of this discussion, is the proxy for national priorities. But it is about making, I think, society understand how the mining industry works, what makes it work and thrive, and how it delivers to society's expectations. So, and this is more than just GDP contribution, tax, and exports. But if you look at the impact that employment in mining has socially, in terms of one person employed in the mining industry supports 4 to 5, in some instances up to 7 people. For an industry that employs about 500,000 people, that's about 3.5 million people that are supported by mining. You look at socially, the employment of one person in the mining industry creates 10 other jobs in downstream industries. That's 5 million people total. So the social impacts of mining are not lost to the mining industry. And so when we are putting forward a case for promoting and protecting the industry, that in essence is what we're trying to protect, those social benefits. But we have to understand that prospecting is no different in entrepreneurial venture as starting out a new business in a different sector. Mm. Running a mine is no different a business as running, you know, another, be it in banking or manufacturing. And so I think every sector has its advocacy and has an interest in protecting itself from regulation. And it's not to say we don't want regulation. I think regulation needs to be less constraining and less burdensome and allow for the market to operate as well.
So just a final one then. If government ignores your concerns, what will the hard consequences be for jobs, investment and future mining projects?
Well, I think we'll see a continued decline in exploration. And I think the worst case could be an even withdrawal of what is currently in place. Secondly, the mining industry is playing a very big role in addressing the infrastructure challenges in electricity, logistics, which are important for both manufacturing beneficiation and routes to market in terms of getting mineral products to external markets, as well as a very important role in enabling other infrastructure like water. So the mining industry is the nerve center of the economy, if I can so much as dare say that. And we believe that the comments that we've made and the suggestions that we've made actually enhance the law and not make it less applicable to mining. It is about enhancing mining and encouraging for investment and growth.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to me. That's the Chief Executive Officer of the Minerals Council of South Africa, Mzila Mthenjane.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you might be aware that South Africa is moving to overhaul marriage laws in a way that could hit the property market directly. Courts may soon be able to override some anti-nuptial contracts, especially out of community without accrual, to redistribute assets at divorce or even death. I think this injects new uncertainty into how homes, bonds and investment properties are split and what banks and conveyancers must do next. It's a serious issue, and let me try and make some sense of it with Renier Krik, Managing Director at Sentinel Homes, who's been applying his mind to this. Renier, a warm welcome. Always good to talk to you. In plain language, if this reform passes, what changes for a couple's house either on divorce or death?
Jeremy, so previously in South African law, we had a very clear way of determining the matrimonial property regime, which is that you had one of three choices. If you did nothing, you were married in community of property, which essentially means that the spouses shared all of the assets which were combined into one common joint estate. Or you could be married out of community of property, essentially meaning that each spouse retains their patrimonial independence, they don't have a joint estate. And then among the out-of-community of property marriages, there were essentially two options. One was called the cold exclusion. That's entirely out-of-community of property, out-of-community of profit and loss. And then the third option was sort of a middle option that says that if the marriage is dissolved, there is accrual, which means that the spouse that had the lowest increase in the value of their estate would share in half of the difference in the increase with their spouse's estate, which is a very convoluted way of arriving at roughly the same result of a marriage in community of property upon dissolution by death or divorce. Now, what's happened is that the Constitutional Court 3 years ago found in a specific case that this particular legal regime is unconstitutional because some spouses, for instance, will sacrifice their financial well-being in the aid of a spouse who would then build up a large estate. Typically, this happens with women, where they sacrifice their career in order to raise children, and then the husband might go on to accrue a lot of assets. And what the effect of a marriage out of community of property would be is that in those cases, the the spouse wouldn't share in the estate in a way that the courts feel are just and equitable. And so this amendment is aimed at addressing that finding by the Constitutional Court regarding the iniquity of certain marriage regimes in the case of dissolution.
All right, so Rania, let's look at remedy now then. How should couples married out of community without accrual rethink title then?
Yeah, so I mean, essentially what this means is that if you're married out of community of property and without accrual, and that's specifically the marriage, the matrimonial property regime that you chose for hopefully a specific reason, then now the courts are going to be able to fudge the boundaries of that very clear arrangement if the judge in the specific case feels that it is just and equitable to do so. So it introduces a large amount of nuance, which in some cases may be unbearable. And actually, the nuance is one of the unintended consequences, because this will definitely be an increased burden on court rolls. Every divorce attorney in the country will now include a claim for redistribution where they represent the spouse that is seen as the financially or economically more vulnerable one, which means that the courts will definitely have a larger burden going forward. And most divorces are now going to have an additional axis on which there may be some form of dispute.
So are there immediate steps then that existing homeowners would want to think about taking?
I mean, so if you're an existing homeowner and you want to think about taking steps to protect your assets from your spouse, then, I mean, there are things that you can do. You can restructure into a company or a trust. A trust is probably not the most optimal solution, given that trust breaking is also sort of a daily activity amongst divorce attorneys. Obviously, that has tax consequences, that has financial planning consequences, and many of those consequences are negative. You might also have to qualify for the mortgage again in the name of the company, or qualify only for a lower loan to value, which means that you'll have to contribute capital to the transaction to make it work. And so this is going to, if you are worried about protecting your assets from your trust, especially if it's something like a house or an investment, a property investment portfolio, or any other assets really that are large and valuable, then you'll have to take specific legal advice about how to take those assets out of your own personal name and put them into some corporate entity where they will be shielded in the case of your spouse's death or divorce.
And where does this leave banks in terms of bond underwriting?
Yeah, I mean, so the banks are not going to be disadvantaged by this, and also not us in the form of our installment sale home loan, because the fact is that the contract counts first, and so only the net value accrues to the estate of the person concerned in the case of divorce. But obviously, it may lead to more properties being sold as a result of divorce in order to comply with these orders regarding the distribution of assets. And as a result, the median half-life of mortgages and other home loans may reduce further than they currently are reduced as a result of this, which will probably mean that banks will have to price slightly higher in order to recover costs in the long term.
And for sellers and agents, I would imagine that there would now be a need for some kind of disclosure risk as far as this process is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, there may be some disclosure risk. But generally, I mean, if someone is married, you'll find that out as part of the KYC process. And if they're in the process of divorce, you probably also know about that. But people don't have to really worry about the people that they're dealing with in the property market having some impediment, because that's really for the courts and the legal process to sort out. So people who are dealing in property generally in the market can just go about their business in the normal fashion, and they don't have to really worry about that.
And does this new discretion apply only to primary residence?
No, it applies to everything, all assets, everything that is in the patrimony of a spouse who's being divorced. Anything that's valuable can be redistributed and divided by the court on the basis simply of the court's impression of fairness.
So my holiday home in Plett, for instance, would be included in something like that. You've got to be very careful.
Everything, including your underpants, Jeremy.
What's the one change that is going to impact conveyances, do you think? What do they need to start doing?
Once again, they'll just go about their business. They don't really have to worry about this, because the courts will prescribe if there is a redistribution order, then the courts will prescribe, and that'll be part of a court order that will be disclosed and will be binding. And so once again, there's no disclosure risk really that's being introduced by this. What is interesting is obviously that all marriages, or all things that look like marriages, are now going to start as part of these amendments to be included in the way that we regulate especially the patrimonial consequences of divorce. While we don't have a set regime yet for the comprehensive regulation of Muslim marriages, the nikah, which previously was excluded from our legal recognition because of the potentially problematic polygynous nature of those marriages, where a male spouse may have more than one female spouse. And that was difficult to deal with from a common law point of view. Now the Constitutional Court has once again made it very clear that these spouses need to have the same protection upon divorce as regards the distribution of assets, etc. And so that's part of these amendments, is that the Muslim marriages are going to get access to divorce courts and are going to be entitled to the distribution of assets and claims for maintenance and all the other things that spouses in a civil marriage can expect. And I think that's a development that needs to be welcomed, because previously especially the female partners in Muslim marriages were very exposed from a financial and legal risk point of view.
Thank you very much indeed, Rania Crick, Managing Director at Sentinel Homes. Appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that is where we're going to end the Tuesday edition of the program. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.